Hello and welcome to Playback Daily for Wednesday, the 9th of April. I'm Louise Herity and here's just some of what's coming up.
What we're saying though is that self-regulation and self-decisions as to what a commercial company will do in order to protect children can't be the way you deal with it.
So when I came to prison this time, I just took the opportunity to just pull away from all that new negative stuff that was happening, and I just didn't want that life no more, and I definitely do not want it.
It's just amazing, and a big long swim there a few minutes ago. It's fabulous, and we had a picnic. I just met my friend here, and we're chatting away. It's gorgeous.
It's hard to believe it's been 30 years since the movie Muriel's Wedding hit our screens, and Jen Gannon joined Sean Rocks on Tuesday night's Arena to look back on what began as a modest Australian indie film and soon became a cult classic.
I'm not surprised, Jen, that you, I'm guessing, have watched this film from start to finish many times over.
Many, many, many times.
Once a year on each anniversary.
Probably even more. As a complicated woman myself who is terrible, just like Muriel is, I think there is that huge understanding for its audience. And when it came out, it was, 6 years before I think Bridget Jones burst onto the screen as well. So you're talking about...
And you can kind of see the precursor of that in
some
ways.
You kind of can.
It's
a lot weirder and a lot wilder than Bridget, but it does express the kind of same frustrations and the dangers of having, the conventional life as your goal through the character of Muriel in a very different, very technical, or very signature. Now we think signature Australian way, but back then I think we were all very surprised about what it was showing us on screen.
How different was it from what we would have considered classic Australian film of that time? I suppose previous to that time, because it created the whole new sense of this indie Aussie type of film which could be made on a shoestring and didn't have to have stars all over it.
Come out of it. There was you had George Miller's Mad Max, which was this crazy kind of futurism and very surreal. So you're used to maybe that world, or Peter Weir's classic, Picnic at Hanging Rock, and the kind of beauty of that. But I think the thing about Muriel's Wedding is we were kind of primed for its weird sense of humour through our love of Australian soaps in the 80s and 90s, because yes, Australian soaps could be very generic, as we all know, but at the same time, Neighbours had this very weird episode where you went into Bouncer's head, the dog. Bouncer had a dream, and it was this whole episode. And then you had something in Home and Away, like Bobby died in Home and Away, and then she came back to Ailsa as a ghost through a fridge. So the Australian sense of humour is offbeat, and I think that kind of fired people up in the notion of responding to Muriel's Wedding in the way they did. So it is part of this new wave of Australian cinema that came in the mid-90s. And they call it the glitter cycle because it's camp, it's kitsch, it's fun. It's Baz Luhrmann's Strictly Ballroom, which just came out of the traps. It felt like out of nowhere in 1992. And was, this rough and ready, but also quite glamorous piece about ballroom dancing. Then you had the absolutely, I can't talk about it enough, a few months, I think, prior to Muriel's Wedding was Stephen Elliott's towering, brilliant The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, which is about three beleaguered drag queens who take off in this bus into the middle of the desert, basically. And you had Guy Pearce, you had Terrence Stamp, 60s heartthrob Terrence Stamp as this, really angry drag queen. But you also had this story about Australia's, LGBTQ community that were out there and very strong. But it was really creative looking. It looked like nothing else you'd see on the screen. And that, I also think, is wired throughout the visuals of Muriel's Wedding too.
Yeah, there is that kind of camp feel, certainly, to the ABBA parts of it. And we'll come to ABBA's role within the film in a moment. None of those films or television series, Ramsay Street is just Ramsay Street. Porpoise Spit, you just don't want to live there, do you?
No.
Even if you've never been there. This is Muriel's hometown. And where does Muriel not fit in, it has to be said, to Porpoise Spit?
It is one of those classic small towns, suburbs, where, you know, everybody, there was the crowds of girls that she desperately kind of wants to be friends with.
They're the queen bee type.
The mean girls who peaked in high school and never got beyond that, but still think they're the centre of their own universe. They desperately want to ditch Muriel. She's really embarrassing to them because, you know, she's not gym honed. She doesn't have the wardrobe that they have. She's not into the music. Like, she's, you know, ABBA at that time, in the 90s at that time, weren't seen as what they are now. So she, it doesn't fit in at all with them. And she just feels lonely and she feels like she's not seen. And especially at home, her father is like this terrible, crooked politician and he rules the roost. And all he cares about is, you know, succeeding in life in any way possible, but also just denigrating his wife and kids.
Oh, yeah, it's so
and,
sad, that relationship.
Yeah.
Like that particular marital relationship.
Yeah, his wife, Betty, is literally just addicted to, you know, painkillers and sleeping tablets because she wants to keep in this almost comatose state because she's dealing with this overbearing father. And that's one of the reasons why Muriel wants to escape as well.
Yeah, well, you can understand why she wants to get out of her family situation. You can also understand why she might want to get out of her, in inverted commas, friends situation. Tanya, Chelsea, is it, or Chesley? Janie and Nicole. I mean, they are just monstrous. And here they are letting Muriel, Toni Collette, know that they are monstrous and that they don't want her next nor near them.
Muriel, people think we're mad, but that's just us. We're ragers. People invite us to parties and they know we'll just have a good time.
We're mad.
Party, party, party. That's our image. You know what I mean.
We're mad.
We don't want you hanging around us anymore.
I didn't steal the dress. It was a mistake.
It's not the dress. It's you. We've told you 1,000 times how to do your hair, but you never listen.
You never wear the right clothes.
You're fat. You listen to 70s music. This is the 90s. We'll listen to the Baby Animals.
And Nirvana.
You bring us down, Muriel.
You embarrass us.
I know I'm not normal, but I'm trying to change. I'm trying to become more like you, more of a...
It's too late.
I can change.
You'll still be you.
There's just something so sad about even you, when you hear Toni Collette as Muriel there in Muriel's Wedding, trying desperately to fit in with a group of people she should just get miles away from as quickly as possible.
Exactly. But in a small
town. Jen Gannon with us this evening celebrating 30 years of the Australian film.
In a small town, she just feels like she's never going to escape that, and they're the only ones around her. But they also have very sad lives as well. They're not these, you know, gleaming, you know, beacons of hope or anything.
No, and the worst makeup in the world.
Some dodgy makeup going on, I will have to say. But, like, you know, they're stuck in loveless marriages as
And
marriage is the only goal. And this film is a lot about, like, those conventions, those societal conventions that women especially find themselves in and what to do. They think there's freedom in this, but is there freedom or is it actually trapping them into a life that they don't want to lead? But is it about the courage to kind of let these things go and move on and move forward? Is that what the goal is, should be?
There's only one way out of porpoise spit. And it's this way. You know, I could watch that sequence over and over again from Muriel's Wedding. It has Toni Collette, not singing, but they're miming herself and what's her name?
Rachel
Griffiths, who plays the character of Rhonda, doing this wonderfully overdressed version of it to those bad women, those mean girls who are their friends. And we do have to talk about that core relationship, which is between the Rachel Griffiths character of Rhonda and Toni Collette's character of Muriel.
Yeah, Muriel heads off on her own on a holiday with the other girls are going on their cruise. She's not invited. She decides to nick some of her dad's money and head off and do it herself. And there she bumps into Rhonda, who's played by Rachel Griffiths, and she is another ex kind of porpoise bit survivor who also was treated badly by those girls. And the two kind of team up, and through this kind of connection, this love that Muriel has of ABBA, ABBA for her is like her escapism. It's about glamour. It's about innocence, about, you know, leaving it all on the dance floor and being able to be someone else and someone new. And Rhonda kind of sees that in her, and she's the kind of friend that just gives her that little bit of a push into trying to be somebody else and be the other person, the best version of herself.
I often think that in lesser hands, both the character of Muriel and the character of Rhonda, as played by Rachel Griffiths, just would have been disastrous. Rhonda in particular, you know, who ends up in a wheelchair and who then gets this awful cancer diagnosis.
Yeah.
You know, that could have just become, you know, Schmaltz City.
It could be Beaches level. But like PJ Hogan, who's such a smart, incisive and writer, he wrote the film as well. He makes sure not to balance this out or look at Rhonda as some kind of angelic figure once she gets the cancer diagnosis or once she has the struggle of being in the wheelchair. She's still as vivacious and full of life as ever, but also someone who's mischievous and completely sex positive and is youthful and out for everything in life, like just wants to live her life on her terms. And what you instead see is some, like with Muriel, kind of pulls away because she still wants to have that conventional life. She's obsessed with getting married and will do it at any means possible. And when there's a kind of schism between the two girls and you see that Rhonda's only option, she's been offered this independence through her relationship with Muriel, but you can see that's actually hanging on the line and she might have to go back to Porpoise Bit with her mother.
Yeah,
Well, there's a reality to it, depending on your friendships.
Here's
can be
the
tough
scene
too.
between Toni Collette and Rachel Griffiths where they're discussing that idea, well, not discussing, where Rhonda is making it absolutely clear she does not want to go back to Porpoise Spit.
How can you stand this? You push me around in this chair, you cook for me, you even help me dress. I hate it.
When I lived in Porpoise Spit, I'd just stay in my room for hours and listen to ABBA songs. Sometimes I'd stay in there all day. Since I've met you and moved to Sydney, I haven't listened to one ABBA song. It's because now my life's as good as an ABBA song. It's as good as Dancing Queen.
Come off it. Promise me something. We never go back there.
What do you mean?
I mean, I can't go back and live in Porpoise Spit with Mum. Not in a wheelchair, not with her.
Oh, you're gonna walk.
Promise we never go back.
I promise.
Toni Collette is Muriel, Rachel Griffiths is Rhonda in a scene there from Muriel's Wedding. Toni Collette, I mean, I don't know how well known she was in Australia prior to Muriel's Wedding, but this launched her into a stratospheric career, really.
Yeah, I mean, you can tell. Like the complicated nature, like as you said, if in the wrong hands, this could have been a straight down the line parody almost. But she really feels
no histrionics.
It.
That's what's so impressive about her.
And there's an innocence to her and a guilelessness that is so endearing and so warm. But also, and you do kind of want to look after her. But also, you see yourself in her too because there's a massive vulnerability within her. Like there is a scene, and it can flip from laugh out loud comedy to absolute you know, emotion. Like there's a scene where she is sliding down the wall in a wedding dress shop because she's going in trying on all these wedding dresses all the time.
She ends up marrying this Olympic swimmer who kind of ends up kind of half falling for her.
He does,
beautiful
she,
Adonis
he,
of a man.
She wins him over, and that's the thing. And she does it in a way that the greatest thing about Muriel's Wedding in a way is that she doesn't change physically. She's not put through this Hollywood makeover machine and is glammed up or anything. She's just herself till the end.
You mentioned
it's attractive then.
You mentioned Bridget Jones there. What other sort of films do you think that have come out of Muriel's Wedding, and also what other characters have come out of Toni Collette's performance? Because it was a new type of woman, I think, that she showed us.
As I said, like that vulnerability, that scene where she's sliding down the wall, and you know, after this massively comic moment where she starts to cry in the wedding dress shop, and she says, "Why can't it be me? Why can't it be me?" And that was something I think struck a lot of women, like that. You know, you're living outside maybe what the social norms are saying. saying about you, maybe physically or the way that you live your life. And it was something very different. And I think that's echoed through a lot of cinema. Bridesmaids, something like Lena Dunham's Girls. I think there's, you know, there would be no Girls, I think, without Toni Collette's performance here.
And Rachel Griffiths, too, who I think is an absolute star. And she was a big, I suppose she went on to the
Six
big
Feet Under.
Six Feet Under was the big
Brenda,
thing.
Brenda, which I think is one of the most important female characters on TV ever. And she did it so well.
Happy Pearl wedding anniversary, Muriel's Wedding. Jen Gannon speaking to us about the film, which is in selected cinemas around the country to mark its 30th anniversary.
Jen Gannon with Sean Rocks on Arena. We've all been enjoying the glorious sunshine this week, and reporter Peter O'Connell was in Kilkee in County Clare yesterday evening, meeting people walking on the beach and soaking up the early April heat while it lasts. This was on Morning Ireland.
When I went in, I didn't know whether it was a nice bag I had around my legs or whether it was the water, but I was told the water, salt water is good, and I enjoyed it. Now the legs are warm now, but it took a while for them to warm up.
It's gorgeous. I have two young girls here, a five-year-old, Sheila Grace, and Annie Mae, a three-year-old, and they love the beach, and we drove all the way from Ogonello to enjoy the sunshine.
What's the best thing about the weather?
The beach.
It's just amazing, and I had a big long swim there a few minutes ago. It's fabulous, and we had a picnic. I just met my friend here and we're chatting away. It's gorgeous. What time of the day is it? And we're still here in the sun, shining. Burr was for a swim as well.
Kilkee is a hidden gem. You're not to tell anybody about it now. It's a very special place. The deck chairs are out and we're meeting up with neighbours now. What more could you ask for in life?
We had our first ice cream of the year walking on the beach on Saturday. Really felt like summertime. Getting line-dried clothes in and everything, it lifts everyone's spirits.
It certainly does lift everyone's spirits. Let's see if we can keep it going. Gerry Murphy, senior forecaster, Met Éireann. Good to be talking to you, Gerry, in sunny weather.
Absolutely, Mary. It's been absolutely glorious weather recently, and not only it's just really clear blue skies everywhere in recent days, and it's quite warm as well. Yesterday we had the highest temperature of 2025 so far, and that was in County Mayo with a temperature of 20.2 degrees, so pleasantly warm. And the good news in the short term is that we can expect more of the same for today and tomorrow Thursday. And sorry, I'm mixing up today and for tomorrow as well, with temperatures again getting up into 21, possibly 22 degrees in one or two spots in the west.
All right, we'll get to what happens after that in a little bit. But listen, bear with me on this. You're a man of science. But in dark times, we've dark times at the moment with the Trump tariff wars. Does the weather tend to smile on us? And I'm thinking back to COVID, you know, when we had glorious weather in late March and April.
Yes, I don't know if there's a correlation between world events and the weather, but certainly we have had occasions when there have been significant events in the country and we've had very good weather. And you're right to mention COVID, the weather during the late March, April, during 2020 was very, very good indeed, very dry and sunny at the start of the COVID pandemic. And even if you historically look further back, to the foot and mouth crisis in 2001, there was very fine weather around this time of year during that crisis as well. So I don't think you can correlate the weather with the crises, but nonetheless, there are occasions in March, April when we do get some fine spells of weather, and we're enjoying one at the moment.
And you know what? We'll take it at the moment. Can you keep it going for us? What's the outlook like?
Well, the outlook is quite very good for today, tomorrow and for Friday. We can expect dry, sunny weather all the way. Now, the temperatures will be at their best today and tomorrow. Once again, it's the western half of the country. We'll get the best of those temperatures because of easterly breezes. So temperatures 14 or 15 degrees in the east, but getting up to 19, 20 degrees, possibly 21 degrees tomorrow in parts of the west, parts of Galway and Mayo. Then on Friday, we will see a slight drop back in the temperatures, though it will be dry, and then a gradual decrease in temperatures over the weekend, and that bit more cloud over the weekend as well. And we'll probably see some showers from Sunday onwards. So in the longer term, temperatures will drop back to normal early next week, back down to about 12, 13 degrees. So back to normal values for this time of year. But certainly in the next couple of days, very warm weather in store, especially over the western half of the country.
So enjoy it while you can. That was Gerry Murphy from Met Éireann on Morning Ireland today. Speaking of sunshine, if you're heading abroad for some summer sunshine, European air traffic control bosses have warned that holidaymakers should expect flight delays again this summer. Claire Byrne was joined by Simon Calder, travel editor with the London Independent, for the story.
Simon, thank you for joining us. Now, people listening to this might be casting their minds back to last summer when delays were pretty bad at times, but now we hear it could be even worse in 2025.
Yes, good morning, Claire. I'm very sorry. I'm always optimistic about travel. You have to be. But looking at the figures last year, exactly as you say, my research says that one in three flights was late in June, July and August last year. And they are undoubtedly, I'm afraid, going to get more delayed simply because there's more people flying and, well, bluntly, there aren't enough air traffic controllers. And then you get events like today when the Greek air traffic controllers walk out, and unfortunately that means no one's getting to Athens, to Thessaloniki, to any of those beautiful Greek islands, or indeed getting out.
Okay, so that is a problem with industrial action. But the greater problem, the one that's going to affect just about everybody flying over the summer, is the fact that there just isn't enough manpower, not enough staff.
Well, yes. I mean, the Eurocontrol, who are the pan-European coordinators of air traffic, say that Europe is a highly saturated network where any issue becomes a network problem. In other words, if flights don't operate when they're supposed to, then it all gets very, very messy. And I'm actually just looking at what Eurocontrol is putting out in terms of warnings to people. There are issues right across the piece. We've got okay, and this is just business as normal. It's nothing to do with strikes. Seville, for instance, the area control centre, which does the whole of southern Spain, they have got 28% more flights this summer expected than before COVID. They don't have the staff for that. There's problems at Marseille, which covers the whole of southern France. Reims in France also, which is lots of routes heading from Ireland across to places like Italy and to Greece. And pretty much wherever you're going, if your flight happens to leave on time, I would take that as a win, because an awful lot of them won't. And of course, the big problem is that airlines are scheduling their flights as tightly as they possibly can to do the most flying they possibly can to make lots of money and to deliver lots of people to their holidays.
And Simon, I know you spoke to the Ryanair boss, Michael O'Leary, about this exact issue in the last couple of days. And let's have a listen to his message to travellers.
It will be worse than last summer, particularly at weekends. The delays will rise, particularly at weekends. And we need, Europe needs to fix what is a broken air traffic control system, which we pay ridiculously expensive fees for.
So the airlines are already accepting that this is going to be worse than last year.
They certainly are. Now, there is actually, I was going to say a quick fix, a relatively quick fix, but it's been 20 years getting nowhere. This is something called Single European Sky. And actually what happens between Ireland and GB works pretty well. There's lots of good coordination. The idea would be to have, instead of all these national borders with, if you're flying, for instance, from Dublin to Croatia, you are likely to go through the airspace of about six or seven different countries. Instead of that, just have pan-European controllers operating much bigger sections of airspace, and things would get much easier. But that's been absolutely stuck in the European mud in Brussels for two decades. It's not getting anywhere. And meantime, we're just looking at more delays, which means extra expense from the airlines. My personal strategy is always to try and book the very first flight, because even if I book a 7 o'clock flight and I'm still sitting on the ground at 8 o'clock waiting for a slot, at least I'm going to get there. It's the end of the day where the problems really arise, especially since there's some big airports around Europe with curfews, and if you can't get into those, then you're not going to be going anywhere.
See, Simon, this is why we value your optimism around travel, because that's a really useful tip. So you're saying to avoid these, well, you're not going to avoid these delays, but to try and mitigate, you book the earliest flight that you can that day.
Yes. Now, the airlines will put in fire breaks during the day. So typically you might have a flight or two in the morning, then the aircraft will be timed to maybe land at Dublin Airport at 1 o'clock with no further flight until 3 o'clock, as opposed to the usual kind of 25 minute turnaround. But those fire breaks can be very quickly eroded. And honestly, it is, as Michael O'Leary says, it's going to be worse than last year. There is very little that anybody can do to avoid this unless they choose not to fly, which, of course, if you happen to be in Ireland and you want to go to anywhere in Europe, is a challenge. You've got fantastic aviation links and, unfortunately, not brilliant surface links.
OK, well, and we've got ferries too, which is an option for people. Simon, we're going to be going on our holidays in a couple of years' time to Bedford in England, I believe. Why?
Because Universal, which is this massive theme park company, and I absolutely love the places they've got in Orlando and also in California, Sentosa in Singapore, and they are coming to the UK. Heaven knows why, apart from obviously there's quite a big market here, but very exciting news. This is a site that no tourist would ever go to for any purpose ever. It's about 50 miles, 80 kilometres north of London, quite close actually to Luton Airport. So if you are a theme park enthusiast, you can just fly in there. Not going to be opening for a few years yet, but anything which adds to the sense of fun in Britain, frankly, has to be welcome, because we're putting up all the barriers to travellers that we can. Anybody who doesn't have the great sense to be Irish from today, if they want to go to the UK, has to pay £16 for an electronic travel authorisation.
Mm-hmm. But if this might make it worth it, because the Labour government is really excited about this. The Culture Secretary's been on the media this morning. The Chancellor has been out. They say it's going to bring £50 billion into the British economy. And when you say Universal is huge in this space, I mean, this is the company behind films like Minions, Wicked, Bridget Jones, Fast and the Furious. So you'll have all of those themes probably in this massive theme park.
Yes, and lots of people like themes. Personally, I just like roller coasters, which go very fast and turn me upside down several times. But
I'm with you.
There we are. I'm looking forward hugely to seeing what they have in mind. Meanwhile, of course, Centre Parks in Ireland is there. And I must say, having sampled them all in GB and some in Europe as well, I'm particularly fond of the one in Ireland, but it is not known for its thrill rides.
Simon Calder, travel editor with the London Independent, chatting to Claire Byrne. A new report on internet safety for children is calling for greater online protections. The Online Safety Monitor from the Children's Rights Alliance warns that failing to have adequate protections creates space for predators to hide. Nolene Blackwell, Children's Rights Alliance Online Safety Coordinator, spoke to Gavin Jennings on Morning Ireland.
What protections are in place for children online here now?
So protections have really only started coming into place quite recently. When you think about it, the whole digital industry has really just been building up over the past 20 or 25 years. And people have actually known there was a need to put boundaries to what you could sell, that there had to be safety, that there has to be some sort of civilized way of selling products on the like digital programs, like social media platforms. But it has taken Ireland and the European Union, to be fair, years to work out what those protections might look like. And right now we have definitely started in this area. We have in Ireland passed legislation a couple of years ago, which has led to the formation of Cumasúna Mann. And within that, there's an online safety commissioner, and they have produced an online safety code. At European level, there's what's called a Digital Services Act, which is to stop illegal content really coming down through the digital platforms. So those things have started being put in place over the last couple of years. But like a whole lot of things, and particularly when you're trying to regulate an industry that spreads across the world and that is used to really just looking to the profit margins all the time, it is cumbersome and is kind of lumbering putting those regulations in place. And in the meantime, there are gaps for those who are particularly vulnerable. And the Children's Rights Alliance says children's rights are not being yet properly protected. We can get there, is the thing. We can actually deal with the harms that are on the internet. We can deal with child sexual abuse, but we're not there yet. And there needs to be kind of a lot of energy and a lot of time and thought put into this, and a lot of coordination, because a lot of people are doing different things in different places. We need to be more coordinated when we're trying to do this big a job, having left it so long to start protection measures.
Much of the protection is left up to companies themselves. What do you make of companies like Meta, for example, creating accounts specifically for teens?
Yeah, well, I think it's really interesting that you notice already that some of the companies are saying there is pressure on us from consumers to do something. People are worried about their children already. You see that you have items on this every week on the news about how parents are worried, about how teachers are worried for children, about how people are worried about the harm that can happen through abusers using the internet. But so you can see that already the companies are saying, oh, wait a minute now, we can't not do this. What we're saying, though, is that self-regulation and self-decisions as to what a commercial company will do in order to protect children can't be the way you deal with it. We don't do that for banks. We don't say to banks, look, you make sure that people only take out loans that they can afford. We put regulations in place as well. So it's a mixture of the companies doing it out of goodwill, and there is goodwill there in some of the companies, but it is also a matter of saying there are basic standards that every company has to comply with, no matter how tempting it is from a commercial point of view to have things like algorithms that lead children into dark spaces, how tempting it is to have it's stuff that can't be seen on the internet, but which allows predators to go in there and groom children. We have to have systems and structures in place that they're all bound by it. Because again, because they're commercial companies, they're competing with each other. And it is probably cheaper for them to do it without protection. So the protections have to be Ireland-wide, they have to be Europe-wide. Ultimately, we may even get them worldwide.
Nolene Blackwell, Children's Rights Alliance Online Safety Coordinator, speaking to Gavin Jennings on Morning Ireland. On Today with Claire Byrne, reporter Brian O'Connell visited Cork Prison to hear about the college course undertaken by prisoners and students.
Now, yesterday, UCC students and 10 prisoners completed the course at a graduation ceremony in the education unit of Cork Prison. And our own Brian O'Connell was invited along to meet some of those involved. So, Brian, this is something that has worked elsewhere and it's now being used in Cork.
Exactly. The Inside Out Prison Exchange Programme, it's been running in many different countries since it began in the late 1990s. It's really about, as you said, bringing together imprisoned students with students from third level for a semester long module, which is held inside a prison. So 10 prisoners engaged with the programme alongside a similar number of UCC criminology students. And at the ceremony I was at yesterday, they presented work. Some sang, some very good singers, some did a rap, some created pieces of art, and they created a booklet as well documenting some of their experiences, and they obviously completed coursework along the way. Many of the students, Claire, had never been inside a prison before this module began. And then for many of the prisoners I met, they were telling me they'd never really spent time with third level students. So both of them, as you can imagine, both of those groups were a little apprehensive at the outset.
OK, and we'll find out how that all worked out in a moment. But overcrowding is a significant issue in our prisons. And you heard firsthand how that is impacting.
Well, many of our prisons are overcrowded. We heard this a few months ago when I was in Mountjoy speaking with staff, and they were highlighting this. It's having a huge impact on the ability of the prison service to carry on the same level of activities for prisoners. So, for example, work, education, rehabilitation services, exercise, they are impacted. But despite this, programmes like the Inside Out one are still running. The current prison was opened in Cork in 2016. It's adjacent to the old Victorian prison, which is currently vacant. And the Irish Examiner reported how the facility has seen a 25% increase in its daily in-custody figures in the past 5 years. I began yesterday with Liam Spacey, Governor of Cork Prison, and he talked, Claire, about the collaboration with UCC, but also referred to the overcrowding issues.
This is the forecourt at the front of the prison, so everybody that comes in enters the prison through here. To your left we have the visitors area where we do our family visits, and to your right is our laundry and kitchen areas, and above that is our workshops.
How many prisoners at the moment?
This morning we have 349 prisoners in custody here.
And what's the official capacity?
296. So we're overcrowded at the moment, as is the whole prison estate.
Just tell me about this programme then. Why is it important from your point of view?
I think it's important for the inmates and the people who live here in Cork Prison to see and experience some of third level education, to realise that it can be an open door for them. It breaks down walls and it changes perceptions, stereotypes and preconceived ideas. They give the students from UCC a unique perspective in criminality, criminology, some of the things they're studying. So it's great for both sides to see that from different perspectives.
This prison, no more than many prisons in Ireland, is significantly overcrowded. That must put pressures on you in trying to deliver programmes like this.
It does create challenges for us, but we're in a very unique position here in Cork in that we have a great staff, particularly in the school. Our head teacher here, Adele Cunningham, is very, very engaged and a real driving force behind the school. Even sometimes when we're having days when everything seems on top of us, I often come up here and talk to Adele, and she's a real refreshing driver of education.
Adjacent to us here is the old Cork prison site, which was closed. Now, is there any talk of perhaps expanding capacity there, of reopening it or redeveloping it? What would be your thoughts?
I know that there's a feasibility study being done on the building in its current state. I haven't seen the feasibility study. We do need capacity, and it is an extremely strategic site. So I have no doubt that in one form or another that the prison service will move on to that site at some stage in the future.
And just picking up on that point around whether the old prison, Brian, could now be developed to create additional capacity. The Minister for Justice visited in recent days.
He was on a visit last week and he acknowledged we have an overcrowding crisis in the prisons. He acknowledged we need more prison spaces. He did say the old Cork prison site is land that is owned by the state, essentially, and he would like to see it used for an extension of Cork Prison. Now, I asked the Department of Justice what plans are in place to try and achieve this, and they pointed to the fact that we have increased some capacity in recent years. For example, spaces have been added in the reopening of the training unit in Mountjoy, new male accommodation in Limerick, and new standalone female prison in Limerick as well, which is very overcrowded. The prison service aims to recruit quite several hundred new prison officers this year, but just specifically in relation to Cork, given the trend in prisoner numbers, the department says, and the pressure on prison capacity, that site of the former Cork prison remains of significant strategic interest, they say, to the Irish Prison Service. Consultants were engaged over a year ago to carry out a detailed assessment of that old Cork prison facility, and this will provide a feasibility report. That report has been received now by the prison service. It's currently being considered. The information I have is that it would be quite expensive to redevelop the site, or to restore the site, if you like, so it may be that the site might be used, but they may be starting from fresh.
OK, well, let's go back now to our criminology graduates. And you said there at the beginning that the UCC students and the prisoners, both groups felt a bit nervous before engaging.
It was really interesting being inside the prison at the ceremony yesterday, because how it worked was a student from UCC and one of the prisoners presented their specific project. But you can see they were very comfortable in each other's company, and they have spent a number of hours every Tuesday working on this module together. So they spoke about the first day when that small group of UCC students went into the prison for the first time, into the education unit, and they met their classmates. There was a lot of uncertainty, a lot of nerves, perhaps there was fear, but after a couple of minutes, stereotypes, preconceptions, they all changed and they really engaged with each other. You'll hear from one of those students and from a prisoner as well. We'll hear first from final year criminology student Marie Fouché describing that very first day.
We came into this tiny room with all these chairs and we were all kind of staring into the whites of each other's eyes and we didn't know what to do, we didn't know what to say, and we had to like move these chairs around to make circles and we were like, oh, sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And it just so quickly came together and I was so surprised by how quickly everything fell into place, how natural everything was, how human I think everything was. That really struck me.
So what were the preconceptions you had and how did they change as the programme progressed?
I imagined it felt like a very cold place from the outside when we came into the parking lot. You see obviously all the bars, you see all the gates, and you have to go through this whole security process. It takes 30 minutes. You're kind of thinking, oh gosh, like am I ever going to, you know, get back out of here? So I don't know. And then we came in and it was just this very normal classroom. I felt like I'd been in a room exactly like this so many times before.
Obviously, you've gained a different type of insight now over the past 12 weeks.
Absolutely. As much as I've loved this course, it's obviously a lot of it is very theoretical. And it's completely different having first-hand knowledge, you know, when, because you can discuss crime as much as you want and offending and people who offend, but to have a person in front of you, to have someone to talk to have someone to exchange with, it's just, there's no comparing it.
So that's final year student Marie Fouché. Now, she worked alongside a prisoner. And for him, the whole process really challenged and changed his views of third level education and of students, actually, as he told me.
I got into education, I suppose, this sentence and hopefully my last sentence.
And before you came into prison, what was your education like?
Poor. I suppose I went to school, if I was third year, done my junior sort. I was just around the roads then after that, Crime was kind of normal, because everyone was committing crime. I didn't know many people, going to college and doing this and that. You know, everyone was, drinking, drugging,
So tell me about the first day, then. You're in the classroom here and there's a group of students come in from UCC.
I suppose, it was nervous for me too, and I know it was nervous for the rest of the lads as well, because I think that was probably the first time I was ever in a classroom, with probably non-criminals, or addicts or anything like that, you know. And the conversations, they just flew, you get me? Very nice people. And
what did you think about students in UCC before you met them?
I don't know. I thought they were kind of stuck up and snobby and all that crap. You get me? I didn't think they'd be... I thought it was kind of posh people with money and all that crap. You get me? They thought they were going to walk into, I don't know, probably a madhouse. I don't know what they thought they were going to walk into, but it's not like that at all. Something changed this time. I remember when I came in this time, even just maybe before I came in, I was still on a kind of a bad path, but I didn't really want it no more. Do you mean I know that inside? I didn't want it. So when I came to prison this time, I just took the opportunity to just pull away from all that negative stuff that was happening. And I just didn't want that life no more. And I definitely do not want it. That's it, for me, I think.
Do you still think students in UCC are stuck up?
No, I tell you, I think every human now is equal enough, I'd say,
And we saw that there was absolutely no disparity at all within the marks. You know, and if anything, the inside students did so much better in some cases.
Prison this time saved my life, in the sense, I came to prison this time. I don't think if I did come to prison, I don't know what would have been possible. You get me? I don't know. Things was getting bad out there and things just wasn't good, you get me? So it saved my life in one sense, and I am happy to be where my head is at today, do you get me?
So clearly he, the prisoner, and Marie, who we heard from earlier on, they both feel that they got something out of this, Brian.
Well, for those on the inside, it helps sort of break down fears around education, opens up possibilities that after their sentence, they can re-engage with education. UCC, for example, had several staff present and they were making the point they have several access programmes which prisoners can avail of. And then for students, it's a real world application and insight which complements and obviously enhances their academic studies. I did speak finally with two people heavily involved with the module. One is Adele Cunningham, head teacher in the education unit in Cork Prison. Up to 150 students will engage with some form of education in any 1 week. And then we'll hear from a senior lecturer in the Department of Sociology and Criminology in UCC. So first up is Adele.
Many, many of our students have left school early. And the reason they have left school early is for a number of different reasons, including chaotic home backgrounds, probably not having the same stability as a lot of students who will go through the mainstream and progress onto higher university. And the bigger picture I would always maintain is that if somebody has a father who has engaged with a module at a university level, there's a much greater chance that that child at a subconscious level will say, well, perhaps down the line I could engage also.
Hi, so my name is Katrina Svirak. I'm a senior lecturer in the Department of Sociology and Criminology in University College Cork.
You can read all the peer-reviewed studies in the world, yeah. But sitting in a room with somebody who's lived a life of crime, yeah, and is, yeah, trying desperately hard, yeah, to change that,
yeah,
gives you a sense of perspective that you're not going to, yeah, get from, yeah. Yeah. Studies.
I really think that's what makes it special for our outside students as well. So we try to sort of equalize and humanize as much as possible, and think through these things together and how they affect us all.
There will be people who will be listening, and comments will come in while I'm on air doing this report, who, sure, will say, that sounds such a cushy life.
The punishment is the deprivation of liberty. As educators, we are then not interested anymore in the punishment aspect.
But you do engage with the fact that there are victims of crime.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, people on the inside, prisoners, have done mistakes and they've harmed people. Sometimes they have done horrible things. They've taken lives. So we acknowledge that pain. But nevertheless, the prison is a public institution, and so is the university. So to provide a public education as a right to people inside is important from a sort of value base. It helps with rehabilitation. The inside students talk about this perception that, you know, oh, you have it like a hotel in there and you have a Nintendo Switch and your Netflix. That is not really the reality. It's much more complex. Your time is still hugely limited. All your movement is monitored. You have very basic access to these things as well. So it's not as easy, you know, as cushy as it seems on the outside.
Thank you very much, Brian, for that. And also to the prison service for facilitating that visit yesterday. Now,
that was Brian O'Connell's report on Today with Claire Byrne. Limerick man Mike Shine was on the phone to Oliver Callan this morning talking about his charity Sock Talk, which he set up with the goal to help spread the conversation about mental health.
How are you, Oliver? How are you getting on, man?
Not so bad at all. Are you well?
Yeah, I've just dropped to school there now, man. I'm putting on sun cream for the last hour.
Oh, good man. That's the thing you have to do.
The missus can put it on in 10 minutes, what takes me an hour. But I decided tomorrow I'm going to get a tray and a paint roller. And I'll be out the door quicker.
That's how hot it is in Limerick, at 10 to 10
it's
in the morning.
That, it's like Love Limerick down here, they're going to be shooting it. Not Love Island.
Come here, 3 years ago you went on this makeover. Why did you go on a makeover show, Mike?
Well, look, it was no secret. I was arrested once or twice by the fashion police, and I felt it was just time to do something. I was wearing tracksuits every day. I had a tracksuit in the day of the week. Was on everyone, every single one of them. No,
were they nice tracksuits? Were they colourful?
They were doing cotton ones, like, you know, and they were the same colour. The only difference on them was you were the day of the week on them, and that's the only way you knew the difference. But Suzanne Jackson's lovely girl, and she went to work on me. I got rid of six of them, but I still have Thursday. I couldn't get rid of Thursday.
Did you own any formal wear at all outside of the tracksuits?
I didn't really, man. That was it. Like, it was just a day of the week, a tracksuit, and that was it. Do you know, the way you would have seen the days of the week on your underwear years ago, I had them on the tracksuit.
Some people look very well in tracksuits. They can be very fetching and very expensive, but you were just getting bland ones.
I wasn't bad in the tracksuit if you were looking at me 50, 60 metres away. Like, do you know, the further away you went, I was looking great. Like,
one person
thought I looked like, I looked like the Hoff from about 150 metres away.
Wow.
Yeah. But when you got closer then, it was kind of going more into Pat Kenny territory.
Pat Kenny in a tracksuit, what an image. Did the show work?
It did, yeah. It was great crack now, and they were really lovely. To be honest with you, no, man, do you remember the movie Pretty Woman in the 80s?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, I actually felt like Julia Roberts up there because I was getting brought around and brought into places and fitting, and everyone was so lovely to me and everything, and the crew and everything. Suzanne Jackson was beautiful and lovely, and they were really helpful. And then they fitted me out then with three finished garments, and I had to pick one. But after that, then I felt I wanted to bring something away from the show. So then I started doing the old socks, you see, you know.
And Sock Talk is the idea.
Sock Talk is the idea, and all the money goes back into charity, the profits, and At the moment, I'm starting here in Limerick with Limerick Treaty Suicide Prevention, or a voluntary group of people in the patrol. The area and look for people in distress. So they need life-saving equipment and they're relying on the public really to fund them and help them. So, but my dream is to get one charity in every county and cover the whole lot.
And it's as simple as you're selling socks that will cheer people up. They're colourful, fetching socks.
Yeah, there's everything on. You can find anything on. The dog ones are brilliant. They're a great seller. Like, there's dogs out there I never even knew were there. There's Cavadoodles and Labradoodles. I thought Volkswagen was making them. I didn't know. I thought it was a car. There's Shih Tzu. I didn't know a Shih Tzu was 6 months ago.
And you do now, and you can't stop saying it.
I can't stop saying it, but you wouldn't mind me trying to say it if it come out from under general anaesthetic, I'll tell you.
There are messages on the socks.
Messages on the socks, and we'll say the mental well-being ones would have, the first one I don't know was it was a blue sock, and it says, I refuse to give in to my blues.
Good idea. Nice.
I'm working away then. I have a chessboard sock, Your Life, Your Move.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good one as well. And on a happier note, and there's music symbols on the side of the sock. And, you know, and I'm the whole time learning because it's all new to me as well, you know.
And they're nice and affordable. They're only $7.99 a pair. Socktalk.ie is the website, and the profits is the Limerick Treaty Suicide Prevention. And along the way, you managed to keep your job going as a driving instructor.
Yeah, so I'd be teaching a lot of the lads now to get into the ambulance service. You need a C1 license. That's the entry requirement. Yeah. So,
do you know what, Mike, I have to take a break. We'll talk to you maybe another time about that. But in the meantime, for today, socktalk.ie is the business.
That was Mike Shine speaking to Oliver Callan. Dr. Harry Barry, GP and mental health specialist, and Dr. Anne-Marie Craven from the Department of Psychology at the University of Limerick were talking about a topic that affects so many of us, cancer.
When you hear the words you have cancer, you automatically gain membership of a club that nobody wants to belong to. And a diagnosis and subsequent treatment of cancer, it not only changes the life of the person concerned, but also the lives of those around them. Well, I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Harry Barry, who's a GP and mental health specialist, and in our Limerick studio by Dr. Anne-Marie Craven from the Department of Psychology at the University of Limerick. And we want to talk about all of those changes that come with those words, you have cancer. Harry, and the diagnosis, you describe it as being like a bomb going off in your life. It can change everything, right?
It changes everything. And I think what's really very important, it doesn't just change everything for you, it changes everything for your family. And the idea of the Cancer Club came for me when a person who had lost their child to suicide, their son to suicide, said to me many years ago, you know, we are sad because we're part of a club now and we never wanted to be part of this club.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, when you're a member of the Cancer Club, you also join because your whole world changes. And it's not just you, the person who has the cancer, but it's everybody around you is affected by it.
And your relationships with friends. I mean, clearly your family, that's going to change. Everyone's worried about you. They see what you're going through and financial circumstances might change. Yep. But your wider circle, that changes too, doesn't it? Those relationships.
Everything around you changes because remember, to battle cancer, very often you have to retreat from the workforce. You lose all that kind of support system. It's very, very, you don't have the energy, you're exhausted, you know what I mean? You're coping with the diagnosis, you have all the emotional impact that we'll talk about later. But you've also got the practical difficulties, the financial problems. Then you have the reality of surgery, for example, if you have breast surgery, you know, the tremendous feeling of that I'm different, I'm not the same person. Then you have chemotherapy and losing your hair and all that stuff and maybe radiotherapy. And you're battling with all of these things. And remember, the people around you who love you and all your friends, they're all involved in this. So it's you become part of a club.
Mm-hmm.
Too. And remember, something that person really got through to me was that unless you're a member of the club, you don't understand what it's like.
So it's a lonely experience.
It's a lonely place.
Yeah.
And I think... people who struggle with this area really feel very isolated.
Okay, Anne-Marie, hello to you and thanks for being with us. Your worldview then, and just focusing on the person who gets that diagnosis, your view of the world changes, is that right?
Yeah, when you have any significant diagnosis, and cancer is a really significant one because it's so common, because it's responsible for 30% of deaths in Ireland, for example, because people understand pretty well what that means when you have a diagnosis. It's different for everyone, but people know that that's serious, right? When you have that diagnosis, it's really a marker in time that changes your sense of the world. So the world was a safe place for you probably, and now you have this information about yourself that changes everything. So a lot of what you thought was important will just go out the window at that point. And I think it's a real test of what really matters in life in that moment. I always think it would be wonderful if we could all have that life lesson of what's important without hearing that news that you have this diagnosis. And of course, besides that, what compounds stress when you have a diagnosis like this is all the practical arrangements to be made. So you have this big shift in how you see the world, but you also have these activities that need to happen, right? You need to make arrangements about work, about looking into treatment options, learning about your particular situation. And then people around you will be caring, but they will also be stressed about it. And you'll feel a little bit like you might need to manage their feelings, but also that you don't want to have to manage their feelings because you need to manage your own. So it's a real marker of a before and after in your life.
Now, thankfully, Harry, the survival rates when it comes to cancer treatment have improved greatly, and there's a good outlook for people, and it's really important to say that. But even with that, there's an emotional impact, and you might just go through the different impacts that people can expect.
Well, I think the you know, it's like a bombshell coming in, and the bottom line is that no matter what you say to anybody, your anxiety levels are going to go through the roof. And anxiety is all about, I want to control the outcome, and you can't. And I catastrophize about how terrible it's going to be. So that makes me very anxious. And even if I survive, do you know what I mean? If I'm technically over all these procedures, I enter the watchtower. And the watchtower is an awful place. It's where I spend
my... What happens there now?
Oh, I spend my life just scanning my searchlight over for any symptom. I'm checking myself all the time aware that this might return. Even if the chances of returning are very small, I still am entering. So it's a terrible place to go, and it's very difficult for those people around you. I think very often a person is very down, and the reason they feel down is because you feel different. Because, for example, suppose I've lost my breast, suppose I've had brain surgery, suppose I've lost my hair. You know, I'm so aware of all those things. I'm different to everybody else.
And the structures of your life.
The
have changed
structures
as well.
Of my life. I am now a cancer. Work, yeah. I'm part of this club. I may be very hurt because, you know, I feel it's not fair. And the one that I think nobody talks about is incredible sadness. And the sadness is all about loss. And it's loss about, you know, who I was. It's loss about the life I'm missing now at this moment in time. And maybe the loss of my future. And imagine, and I've had to walk this walk with a family, with my own brother and with others. Suppose my diagnosis is terminal. Mm-hmm. Suppose I know that I only have a certain amount of time to live. Well, imagine the sadness that I feel of all the loss that's in front of me. Do you know what I mean? And I have to say, I've interacted with people in this situation, and a big hug out to a certain person, Udell, out there who's struggling with this. But, you know, I have just nothing but admiration for these people.
Yeah,
how they manage to create a kind of a positive spin, you know, on something which is so traumatic, you know.
And that was Dr. Harry Barry and Dr. Anne-Marie Craven on Today with Claire Byrne. And that's all we have time for on this edition of Playback Daily. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and take care.